Hello, everybody, and it is a huge pleasure to listen to one of the most distinguished, celebrated economists in Britain and beyond, Andy Haldane, former chief economist of Bank of England, very distinguished role he played there, former chief executive of the Royal Society of Arts, former member of the Government's Economic Advisory Council, and much more. And we're going to be talking about the economy today, and I've got some questions. I'm going to, from some students, I'm going to be reading out their questions in a moment, bringing in to Andy. But I just wanted you to begin. Can you give us a sense of why is Britain here? And we're recording this. This is November 2025. Why is Britain in such an economic mess? Why does Britain owe so much and has so little to show? And why has it borrowed money as so unwisely, so that we are racked by debt repayments? And what is the hope? So that's just a general beginning question.
Wonderful. Well, Anthony, fantastic as ever to join you. And hello to all the students and parents listening in. That's a mammoth question, Anthony. I hope I can say a few coherent things that speak a little bit to it. And maybe a little bit of historical context does help a bit here. Because if we looked at the previous century, the 20th century, a distinguishing feature of that century was we managed to maintain, with a few bumps along the road, a reasonable average growth rate of about 2% a year. Now, that doesn't sound like anything to write home about, 2%. But such is the beauty, the genius of compound interest. That meant that living standards rose more than sevenfold during the course of the 20th century, which is a true transformation in our fortunes, to the point where progress, growth, rising living standards, Anthony, became a social norm. It's what we came to expect. And so too did governments when it came to spending money on public services and the like. And then we fast forward to this century, the 21st, and the growth tap has been turned, if not off, then it's been tightened very materially. We've seen growth of probably less than a quarter of that, about 0.5% a year, over the course of the 21st century. And we've seen even more anemic growth in people's pay packets. Once we adjust for inflation, the average British worker is worse off in inflation-adjusted terms than they were at the dawn of the global financial crisis in 2008. And you have to go way back to before the Industrial Revolution to find a similar such period of stasis in living standards. And as you mentioned, Anthony, not coincidentally, over the same period, over the course of the 21st century, we've seen the public debt load of the government relative to national income almost treble over the course of a quarter of a century, which is without precedent in peacetime. There is no historical precedent for such a bulge in public spending and in public debt outside of wars. So what then has gone wrong? Well, I mean, one of the things that's gone wrong is that the 21st century has ushered in not one, but a whole sequence of nasty, once in a generation, come once in a century surprises. That probably began with a global financial crisis getting on for 20 years ago. But then we had the aftershock from that in the euro area. We had Brexit. We had COVID. We had the cost of living crisis. And now we have our set of geopolitical crises. And each and every one of those generated a ratchet in public debt, a bulge in public spending. And it's that ratchet in debt and bulge in spending that has taken debt up to approaching a year's national income, and interest payments on that debt up to around £100 billion per year. You know, that's roughly around the education budget, and comfortably more than we spend on defence. So in part, the explanation for this is this sequence of very nasty surprises that there haven't been war, but their fiscal consequences have sometimes been as bad as war. COVID added 20 percentage points to the public debt load relative to national income. Nothing outside of war has done anything similar to that. So there's that, which in some ways is bad luck. And were it all bad luck, we could perhaps take a crumb of comfort from that, that perhaps our run of bad luck won't continue. But truth be told, it isn't all bad luck. It's been bad luck combined with poor macroeconomic management. You mentioned that we have simply failed to radically, or indeed even modestly, reform public services. The UK has not run a fiscal surplus, that is to say, tax revenues exceeding government spending, this century. For 25 years, we've run fiscal deficits, and big ones, currently running at around 4% of annual national income. Over that period, Anthony, productivity, the efficiency with which government resources are used, is no higher today than it was at the time of the new Labour administration coming up in 1997. So we have failed to reform and make efficient and productivity the means by which we provide services to the public. And just to make clear that not all of the fault lies with government, the lack of investment in both technologies and in people has been a feature of government policy, but has also been a feature of British business. Regrettably, and rather miserably, we sit towards the bottom of the international league table when it comes to investment, both in kit, machines, and buildings and technologies, and when it comes to investment in people, their skills and experience. And there is no more cast iron law of economics, Anthony, that one that tells you if you fail to invest in the things that grow your economy and grow your living standards, like technology and like people, the fruits of that will show up in weaker growth. And that has been the story, regrettably, of the 21st century.
So, I want us to be looking very much at what we can do about this, Andy. And we're going to have some extraordinary questions coming in from the economists at Wellington College, brilliant people, including Wilfie Munro, Henry Hume, Jamie McGeoch, Martha Cunliffe, Pietro Moncado, and Zach Heiner, and others. But what's this saying? I mean, they're studying economics. What's it saying, Andy, about the economics discipline, if both the public and the private sector have got worse, as we're learning, as we've got more economists than ever, more people studying economics, but actually we're doing worse, both sectors. Is that the economics is wrong, or is it the people are applying or not applying it, or applying the wrong economic lessons?
Yes, yeah, so I think a couple of points on that, Anthony, if I may. I'd be the first to say, or maybe one of the first, that economics and economists have been part of the problem. I think at times in the past we have applied too narrow a lens to the question of what stimulates growth. So my preferred model of growth, a recipe for growth, is similar to the recipe for baking a cake, Anthony, to be honest.
Lots to learn about cake making, from cake making.
There absolutely is. And for me, one of the key ones is it's pointless asking the question, what's the single most important thing we can do to lift growth? Because it's a bit like asking, what's the single most important ingredient in baking a cake? The answer to which is the one that's missing. And that's true when it comes to growth as well. We have had not one, but several missing ingredients. And unless and until we add those ingredients, we can't expect the cake to rise, the economy to grow. And through focusing rather too narrowly, economists have missed out some of the key ingredients. Let me mention one, and one that you and I have discussed in the past, Anthony, which is the importance of social capital, the importance of relationships, of connections, of who you know as well as what you know. They tend to be missed out from the economist's recipe book for growth. But we all know that social capital, those connections and relationships, are foundational to how well a school functions, foundational to how well a business is run. They're foundational to how well a community works. And ultimately, they are foundational to how well an economy works. And they tend to be neglected by economists, and that is mea culpa. And we've got bits of that wrong by applying too narrow a lens. Nonetheless, and this is my second point, even if we as economists, as the economics profession, had the perfect recipe book and had given that to successive chancellors, the bigger problem has been actually in the delivery of that at scale. And both bits are important, both the delivery and the at scale bit. When I look back over successive governments, successive chancellors, Anthony, all of whom you've done amazing biographies of, the problem is often not that they've completely misdiagnosed the problem or even misprescribed the solution. It is that they've failed to apply the medicine with the requisite degree of scale and strength to tackle the underlying problem. They've underprescribed in terms of strength. The medicine, and that has left growth subdued. So I think it's a combination of a miss on ideas and theories, for which mea culpa, combined with a larger failure to deliver and to deliver at the scale necessary to rise to the challenges of our time, which, as you all know, are many and various.
So is this a case then for getting rid of democracy, given that some of the more successful countries like China don't have democratic systems? Has democracy here coming into the domain, obviously, of politics, of philosophy? Has it simply failed? Does it need rebooting? How can we get capable politicians? As we are talking today, Andy, we are just a few days away from a budget widely predicted to be in trouble. What has happened? And because this is so many of what the problems you're talking about are across leading industrial nations of seeing growth.
Yeah. So, I mean, I, for one, would not be at the point of wishing to abandon democracy. Although, of course, as you and everyone else on this call knows, there is more than one flavor of democracy. It can be carried out in different ways. And of long standing, I've been strongly of the view that a flavor of democracy that engages more fulsomely with the general public, a sort of deliberative democracy type approach on key issues, of which education would be one, the environment would be a second, there are many more besides, is really important for binding in and giving voice to the often voiceless citizens in our society who, as a consequence of that, are both disillusioned and mistrustful of our political classes. Even with that, though, it's clear that we need real leadership, genuine leadership, backed up by real ideas, genuine ideas, if we are to rise to those challenges. I'm increasingly of the view that I don't know whether our political system, with all its foibles, is capable of spawning a leader capable of rising to the challenges of our time. I mean, it's a genuine question for me right now whether the system as configured could create, procreate such a leader. I do not see lots of evidence of having done so either currently or over the recent past, which begs for me the question, is there something, someone outside of the political system? Maybe it's in business. Maybe it's in education. Maybe it's in civil society. Maybe it's in academia. Who has the energy, the ambition, the vision, and the philosophy to drive this through top to toe? I pose that, Anthony, as a genuine question. It's what I've been reflecting on a lot over the last month, including in conversations with some of the great and good. Truth be told, relatively few names have risen to the surface over the course of that conversation, which itself is a little bit depressing. Claudia Winkleman from Traitors had a mention on more than one occasion, but I'm not sure Claudia's up for it, to be honest. And if not Claudia, then whom? So what I do think is that this will require someone who has run something, and who can act with true leadership and authority in driving through change. And I'm afraid, you know, few of those within Westminster currently that would score well on that very straightforward and criterion. It probably does require someone from beyond the palace to make, that's Westminster rather than Buckingham, to make that happen.
So here we are, Andy. We have this very significant issue and concerns in the economy and aging population, which the pupils are thinking about, concerns of equity with growing, depending how you measure it, growing inequity, a public service system which is extraordinarily inept, with no one with the ideas. Is the core democratic problem the fact that to get elected, you're going to have to make promises? And for all the efforts of bodies who are scoring commenting on the promises of politicians at general elections, to get elected, you still need to promise a better country, which means more spending. And therefore, the spending level is ratcheted up. And that extraordinary figure that you mention about how since the beginning of this century, government spending has always been bigger than government tax receipts. I'd just push back again on how what democracies have coped well. And is this an argument for a president like Trump who can provide that strong dynamic leadership, or F.D. Roosevelt 90 years ago with the New Deal? Before we come back to the economics, just a comment there on the politics of the economics.
Yeah, so I suspect we're looking for someone more Rooseveltian than Trumpian, Anthony.
I think so.
But in recrafting the social contract as much as the economic and commercial contract, I think that's absolutely needed. Because although you know, the economy is a big part of this. It's the cratering of social capital that worries me every bit as much as the cratering of human and physical capital. I am a great believer, as you know, I think, and as are you, that leadership is often best exercised locally. And we are, as a nation, even with efforts to devolve over the last 10, 15, 20 years, the most centralized state in the Western world by some margin. And although people are generally speaking disillusioned and mistrustful of national politicians, many still harbor a degree of confidence and trust in local leaders, including increasingly the crop of local mayors. Wow. So I do think part of the way of closing this democratic deficit is by localizing decision-making in both local, and when I say local leaders, Anthony, I don't just mean local government versus national government. That's not just what I'm talking about. I am talking about that. I think we need more than that. We need local governance as much as local government, by which I mean an alignment between, yes, local government, but as importantly, hospitals, schools, universities, businesses, transport systems, civil society, and the like. That joining of the dots between those different sectors is absolutely the secret source of success and absolutely the wellspring of growth. That'd be almost my biggest learning from my more than 30 years in public policy, that the magic comes in the intersection between sectors rather than within. So don't just ask what government's getting wrong. Let's ask how we fuse together and coordinate the efforts of all those stakeholders. Whitehall, national government cannot do, never has done, and I suspect never will do, joined up writing. Joined up writing, joined up policy making, I think, is only possible at the local level. And that at least is part of my answer to your very good challenge.
And there you would point to, before we move on, which particular city mayors would you highlight?
Well, although he's not necessarily flavour of the month on Downing Street at the moment, I mean, Andy Burnham from the Greater Manchester. Greater Manchester is now a very considerable success story. Now, the part of this that Andy will like less is when I say that the reason for that success, the foundations for that, were set well before Andy turned up as mayor. They had 20 years of then leaders in Greater Manchester, Richard Leeson, Howard Bernstein were their names, provided doing that joined up conversation between sectors, you know, going way back to the start of this century. And then Andy's been able to come in as mayor, Andy Burnham as mayor, and take it on to the next level, to the point now where I think Greater Manchester is flying. It is flying and could be left to its own devices. It's drawing in people. You know, Greater Manchester is now a very significant net importer of graduates. It's a significant net importer of money, both domestic and foreign. Significant net importer of businesses. It's reached critical mass. It's been proof positive of what's possible local. And of course, not everywhere is Manchester, nor should everyone seek to be Manchester. But it shows what is possible through local leadership and local governance, plural, not singular. And I think if you want something that doesn't even cost government money, let's start by doing devolution properly, rather than the half-hearted way we have so far, Anthony.
You're not saying that economic students at Wellington schools and economic students everywhere should stop doing their A-levels, but that we need to apply it better. Let's go on then to going back to July 2024 and asking what have been the most helpful measures by this government towards the private sector and the economy at large, and what have been the most damaging? What will history say?
Of what timeline would you want me to cover for that, Anthony?
The beginning of the Labour government.
Of this one?
Yeah.
So let me mention three places where I think certainly very directionally helpful steps have been taken. The first would be efforts to reform our horribly sclerotic planning system, which is sorely in need of further reform. The second is very early on, and actually rather forgotten, regrettably, now, the government commissioned what would end up being an excellent position paper on what we need to do in AI terms by Matt Clifford, who's a business person, AI expert, which came up with some very sensible, very practical recommendations of how we can go through the gears when it comes to applying, indeed developing AI as a sector, and indeed across sectors. And the third example, a very recent one actually, Anthony, was the review the government commissioned Sir Charlie Mayfield, who's formerly chief executive of John Lewis Partnership. He was asked to look at how we tackle the problem of sickness related inactivity in the workplace. When the truth is, these are terrible numbers. We have 9.5 million people across the UK. That's almost a third of the workforce who are neither earning nor learning, not in work, not seeking work, not in training, not seeking training, what's sometimes called the NEETs, of which, even more scandalously, almost 1 million are between the ages of 16 and 24. Now, not all of those reasons for inactivity are illness-related, but around a third of those people are not working or learning by dint of illnesses of various types. And the Mayfield Review looks into how we get many more of those people back into work, which is a double benefit, of course. It's a benefit in that then means those people are not claiming welfare benefits, which is a saving to the public purse. But it's also a saving to the public purse in that those people, when working, are paying tax. It's a twin-win for government, as well as being a huge boost for the individuals concerned, because we know that work is fantastic, not just for your bank account, but also for your wider well-being and health. And the thing I liked about the Mayfield review is rather than it being a laundry list of 110 recommendations that government should go away and carry out, which tends to be the way with government reviews, and I say that because I've written quite a few of them myself, instead, what Charlie Mayfield did was, he said, I'm just going to do it. I'm going to demonstrate by deed rather than word. And he brought together around 60 businesses and just said, we're going to do it. We're going to commit to getting people in the doors as employees of our businesses who otherwise would be claiming sickness-related benefits to show it can be done. And I think that's one, it's tackling a big issue, but two, it's tackling in a very purposive, action-oriented way. So those are three areas where I think this government has made some useful steps directionally. If I was pointing to one or two where the progress, I think, has been rather...
Stymied.
Or has lacked the forcefulness and scale, that word again, that I think we'll need. One, and for me, this is the key one. I know it's an issue on which you are very much more the expert than me, Anthony. It's been a lifelong passion of yours, is that the government commissioned a review of the school curriculum, which reported a couple of weeks ago. And it also drew up a white paper on skills, if you like, the bit after education. And, for my money, they both lacked the scale and the degree of reimagining needed to rise to the labour market challenges that the 21st century is ushering in. Our skills system is quite broken. That's among the reasons why 9.5 million people are economically inactive. They have their skills are not at a level that makes them easily employable. And that one of the reasons for our productivity malaise is because even those that are in work often lack the skills to make best use of the kit they have available. And I reckon there's more than 20 million people across the UK, you know, well in excess of half the workforce, who are in one or other of those boats. And that's a fail. That's a big fat fail for our education, learning and skill system that's lifelong. It's the biggest of deadweight costs, because if you're out of the system, if you're one of those neets at age 18, what chance of getting back in the system of training and work at age 25 or 45 or 65? So I think we simply have not applied anything like the amount of rigor and radicalism that we need to reformation, root and branch reformation of our education and skill system. And by that, I don't just mean in among young people, among those listening to this call. You know, we've spoken over many a decade, you would know better than me, about the importance of making a reality of lifelong learning. And we have singly failed to do that. And that becomes an ever larger lacuna the more we age as a population. And we need people to be staying on in the world of work beyond the age of 50 or 55 or 60 or 65. And they're being lost to work because they were lost to learning at an earlier stage. So if I was picking one from a long list, Anthony, of places that have been subpar, I might start with one of your favourite subjects, and that will be education, their skills and training.
Okay. And there are, of course, many others, including National Insurance. And we had Emma Bridgewater on the podcast recently talking about how hugely handicapping it's been to her employment of people in her pottery factories, where it's more expensive because National Insurance, and it's the changes to labour regulations means that she has to be much more careful about who she takes on. It's astonishing to me that the Labour government should be making work more difficult while at the same time sending abroad and not bringing into this country, not encouraging into this country people who are the most productive and agile intellects and entrepreneurs. We're just going to finish, if I can, with just, you know, two-sentence answers. This is going to be, and these are picking out from the student questions I didn't come across there. Why are unearned income than earned income, capital gains, et cetera, and should this change? So quick question there.
I mean, the case for them being levied at different rates is because you can make a case for there being a greater chance of income from capital rather than income from working being reinvested, for example, in businesses, and therefore being a future source of even higher tax revenues. That's the in principle case. In practice, the evidence on that is rather thin. And were it me, I think there's a stronger case for equalising than from having levied at different rates, Anthony.
Okay. Next quick fire question. What are the tax changes, change in the tax system you would make to increase incentives, but also fairness?
Lots of things that can and should be done. I mean, tax reform generally is one of the few areas where economists, left and right, agree, actually. And the problem with that, certainly, I mean, there aren't many of those things, Anthony, as you know, but tax is one where they do. The single most important thing we do, the UK has the longest tax code in the world. I think it's 21,000 pages now, Anthony. And there's no good reason for that. Literally no good reason for being at that length. So the single biggest thing, biggest and most important thing that could be done is to streamline and simplify that tax code, to chop down the tree and plant a new sapling rather than pruning the leaves, which seems to be the proclivity of chancellors past. There's things then that could be done, but that's its most important.
And the next quickfire one would provide the solution, which is AI. So if you feed the 21,000 pages into AI and say, come out with 20 pages, it could do it in a nanosecond. But why would government want to do anything that you could do so quickly? But the next question is on AI, Andy. Is it going to do more to boost economic growth than it is to put people out of work?
The truth is we don't know. I mean, not that we don't know, we can't know. But my best guess will be that, one, AI will generate significant amounts of value added and income, and that it won't be a great jobs killer. In other words, because it will change the nature of work rather than the quantum of work. That's been the lesson of previous industrial revolutions. So I don't think, to take an example, you're a GP. Do I think that 30 years hence, AI will be doing much more of the diagnostic work clinically? Yes. Do I think it'll be doing much more of the prescriptive work clinically? Yes. Do I think that sounds the death knell, therefore, for doctors? No. Because the human element of this, communicating the results of that AI, the bedside manner, the interpersonal skills, the social capital, if you like, will be even more important, even more of a premium.
Precisely, what schools at large of November 25 has not prioritised, the human side. It's doubling down on the very things that the algorithms will always outperform us on. Next question from the students. What is the most underreported economic challenge facing the UK economy?
I think it's aging. I mean, people talk a lot, possibly too much, about AI. They're still talking a lot about climate. They're still talking a lot about inequality. And there was a, three horsemen of the apocalypse. They talk too little about demographics and aging, in my view. I think that could be an equally potent force for ill or for good in shaping our societies. And the for good bit's really important, because we often talk about aging like it's an unalloyed bad, whereas living longer lives is an unalloyed good, provided you adapt your systems to take advantage of the longer life that you are living. And that means reconfiguring our skill system, reconfiguring our business approaches, employment among older people, reconfiguring our pensions and benefits system, and the like. You do that, and aging starts paying a dividend rather than levying a tax on the economy. And that's the world we need to move to. We're talking too little about that right now, Anthony.
I'm still not certain from what you're saying where the jobs are going to come from, but let's hold on to that while we just come back to the next brilliant question from the students, which is a quick answer, Andy. Should the UK rejoin the EU, or if not the full EU, the customs union, single market?
These are fantastic questions, and that's me obviously playing for time in not answering that.
But they are fantastic questions.
Do I think there is the consensus politically across the country right now to be wholesale rejoining? No, I'm not sure that there is, although surveys suggest the balance has tilted significantly since the Brexit referendum. Is there scope for writing with the EU a much, much better trade deal than one we're currently in? Yes, there is. There ought to be two-sided appetite for that, because guess what? The continent of Europe is not going gangbusters either right now. So there could be a mutuality of interest in striking a better deal with our nearest trading partner, and I certainly hope that we do.
The euro was at a lost opportunity back at the beginning of this century.
No, it was a bullet dodged.
Bullet dodged? Well, that's a very quick way to go with that one. What about tariffs? And should we be becoming much more protectionist like the US? Wouldn't that do wonders strategically to build up our strategic industries, automobile, steel, food? And why don't we do that? Should we do that? Why not?
Two bits to that. So I don't think raising tariff barriers is the route to salvation. Lower trade tends to translate into lower growth, and that diminishes living standards. But there is something important but around that. Economists, my profession, were for too long blasé about the benefits of free trade, not recognizing that there are losers from free trade and big losers from free trade, and you do a much better job of understanding the concerns of those who lose out and supporting them, not necessarily in maintaining industries that don't have a future, but in helping them migrate to industries that do have a future and the skill shift that's required. So there's more nuance around global trade than the good or bad for or again debate that's taking place right now.
And the final question is, if you could restart the economy, and why would you not want to do that, Andy? What can we do to have a more equitable country and to help those people who for whom poverty is such a limitation to their engagement with life, family life, productive life? Can it be done? And has communism succeeded in producing economic efficiency with also dealing with poverty much better?
So we cannot equalize outcomes, but we need to do a much better job of equalizing opportunities. And therein is the key for me, to create for every individual that ladder of opportunity that enables them to climb. I think this is, rather than talking about growth and GDP and these abstract, arid terms that mean nothing, by the way, to most people, it should be all about individual opportunity and creating that sense of optimism and opportunity among everyone. That's what drives happiness and well-being. And ultimately, that is what drives growth, because growth starts from the bottom up. It starts from individual growth, from individual progression. Everyone should see the ladder that they have ahead of them. Everyone should have rungs on that ladder. And the role of government is enabling them to climb. That starts at the earliest of years, but then progresses on a lifelong basis. That is the route to tackling inequalities. That is the route to tackling issues of poverty. And now is the time, if ever, to create those ladders, Anthony.
And final one word answers. Who do you think has been the greatest economist?
Influential
and effective. All time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a... there's a risk here in going to the obvious, and the obvious would be John Maynard Keynes, almost the inventor of the discipline of macroeconomics. So I'll not give that answer because everyone will have heard of him and know the Keynes story. I will say instead Herbert Simon, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics, and much less well known.
Herbert Simon, that's someone for people to start looking up rapidly. Who's been Britain's most successful, best Chancellor of the Exchequer?
In my lifetime,
I think ever
will be pushing it. In my lifetime, which makes it a bit easier, I think Nigel Lawson had the rare combination of, whether you believed it or not, It was rooted in a philosophy of what needed to be done and executed with a degree of aplomb.
Chancellor, 83 to 89. And finally of all, and leaving aside the present incumbent Bank of England governor, who has been the greatest governor in the Bank of England in history?
Oh, in history. I mean, again, everyone would say, most history books would say Montagu Norman, who was governor for 20-odd years at the Bank of England. Remarkable figure. Again, slightly eclectic, eccentric figure, as it turns out, a Montagu Norman. I had the benefit, and it actually was a huge benefit, as well as a privilege, of working alongside five governors in my 32 years at the Bank of England. And they all had huge, huge virtues. I learned huge amounts from all of them. It's invidious to pick favourite governors.
It is invidious.
It's invidious to pick favourite children.
Who will history say was the most consequential?
I suspect of those that I encountered, the most consequential will probably be seen to be Eddie George.
I knew you were going to say that.
He was governor at the time.
A man of real
humility and wisdom, from whom I learned an enormous amount. So although he's not maybe in lights in the same way as would be a Mark Carney, now Prime Minister of Canada, or a Mervyn King, who was the governor I probably worked most closely with. Eddie George had the wisdom and the experience that I think at moments like this, Anthony, troubled times for the UK economy, are just what is needed. The sure touch, the sense of deep knowledge, but wrapped up in a very can-do practical. That is what the sort of public servant the UK sorely needs right now to rise to all the challenges that we've discussed this morning.
So we're finishing there on wisdom and on a tour through economics and business and politics and psychology and philosophy and indeed quite a bit of sociology. And what a tour d'horizon. And thank you, Andy Haldane, very much indeed.
Thank you, Anthony. Fantastic as ever to speak to you all. And to all the students, don't be put off by the gloom and doom that I've been spreading. That is the endowment of issues that everyone would wish to have. That is the reason to study economics, to study social sciences, and to make a difference, and I hope you do.
Thank you. That's a great note to finish on.